Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Ambassadors of Hope. I'm your host, Charles Bender. We're so excited that you've tuned in to hear from local South Florida leaders who are making a difference in our community and region through our charity, Place of Hope.
Hello, I'm Maya Elias, producer for the Ambassadors of Hope podcast by Place of Hope. Today, we're privileged to have Tori Hope Peterson as our distinguished guest. Tori's journey through the foster care system, overcoming adversity, and finding solace in track and field is truly inspiring. She candidly shares her experiences of abuse, instability, and her eventual triumph as a four-time state track and field champion. Tori's quest to reconnect with her biological father, utilizing platforms like Ancestry DNA, underscores her resilience and determination. She reflects on the emotional roller coaster of reaching out to potential relatives and the profound impact of discovering her biological family, particularly her father's sister. Throughout her narrative, Tori underscores the importance of embracing uncertainty and gratitude in reunions. Moreover, Tori advocates for proactive support systems for youth in foster care, stressing the significance of equipping them with the essential tools and resources before they transition to independence. She eloquently speaks to the healing power of storytelling and the necessity of providing survivors of abuse and trauma with safe platforms to share their experiences. In addition to her advocacy work, Tori shares insights into her personal life, including her passion for hospitality, cooking, and her role as a devoted mother. Currently, she's channeling her experiences into a new book aimed at breaking destructive patterns and generational cycles. Join us for the remainder of this poignant and uplifting episode, where Tori Hope Peterson's story continues to inspire and motivate.
Well, welcome to the Place of Hope podcast, Ambassadors of Hope. We're in the studio today with a special guest from out of town who came into town to speak at our 10th annual Angel Mom Brunch. Tori Hope Peterson is here with me in the studio, and I'm going to let her give a little introduction about herself. But she's just a lovely girl. We've had such a great day. And after we have a big event like this, it's kind of like planning a wedding. You spend months and months and months and months. And then finally the day is here. It's just like, oh, afterwards. But I'm so glad that we can share you with our listeners and other Place of Hope supporters who maybe didn't get to be in the room today. So Tori, welcome to Place of Hope and welcome to our podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It felt like a Super Bowl, that event did. It was awesome. And I was so honored to share my story with your guys' audience, like such genuine people who want to care and love children who need care and love.
Well, you've got a great story of hope. We love your middle name, by the way. And, last summer or last spring when we had this event, Amy Kasma, one of our angel moms, she kind of pulled me to the side and she goes, okay, this is great, but we need to go bigger and we got to get a speaker and I want you to do some research. And I came across your story on another podcast. And I think it was the Nothing is Wasted podcast. Yeah. I'm pretty sure. And then I started doing my research and looking you up and man, what a story. And you are such a light. And I think by telling your story, you're helping countless other young adults who don't have a voice and we were talking about this in the car a little bit. I mean, a lot of times these kids, they don't want to tell their story. They don't want to talk about their trauma. And there you up are on the stage today and making everybody laugh and and having fun with it. So let's tell your story. I want you to share your story because I think a lot of people would like to hear it.
Yeah. Well, if we don't laugh, we're going to cry. So we can do both, but I really like to make people laugh and I like to make people happy. So it meant a lot to me afterwards. A lot of people said, you're funny. And I was like, oh, that's the best compliment that you can give me is to say I'm funny and I make you laugh because so much of the story is so hard.
Yeah.
I was born to a single mom who absolutely did the best with what she had. I think it's really important to say that before I was born, my mom is a trafficking survivor. My mom was abused and her parents died, passed away very young. And so she didn't have anyone to help her out of the situation that she was in. She was like a teenager. Her dad moved her from where I now live, Defiance, Ohio, small rural town, to Houston, Texas. And then her parents passed away and she was there all by herself. She was in Houston, Texas. Like she was just a kid really in her early 20s and she was being trafficked and she didn't really have anybody, didn't have a community to lean on, didn't have people. And I mean, when you think about your guys' organization, it's so wild because like there are literally, right, you were telling me in the car a story of a girl, a very similar situation, gets dropped here in Florida, left basically by her parents. Like where did my mom have to go? If your organization would have been where my mom was, like my story would be very different because my mom just didn't have any place. And I just think it's so important to give that context because my mom is not a villain. My mom is not this terrible person. Mm-hmm. She was a kid who didn't have all these resources that we have today, that didn't have what I have, what I did have as a kid. So I was born and, you know, my mom was really on her own, did not want me to be raised in Houston. She felt like she had so much trauma there and it was really important that I wasn't raised there. So she moved us back to where she was originally from, which is where I'm from, is Ohio. My mom, she always said she loved me. She always said that she wanted the best for me from a very young age. I remember from like the age of 4, my mom told me I had to go to college. I had to be an educated woman. That was always very important to her. I know that my mom wanted the best for me, but she was involved with dangerous people. I ended up going into the foster care system due to a drug bust. There were uniformed men busted through our front door. I was probably like 4 years old. And they just took, you know, bags of drugs down from the cabinets. And this nice young woman came, swooped me up, took me to the backyard. And she just said, we're just going to go somewhere for a little while. And so I went into my very first foster home. And during that time, I was like, I do not want to be here. I want to be with my mom. My mom loves me. My mom provided for me. I mean, it was with drug money, which I didn't know was bad, but I was provided for. I did have a relatively, you know, it appeared stable. It felt stable. It didn't feel dangerous.
It was your normal.
It was my normal. It was my normal. And you don't, when you're that young, you don't know what you don't know. So I just wanted to go back. I just wanted to be with my mom. My mom, you don't have a concept of time when you're 4 years old, but my mom said I was in the system for about 6 months. The system did one of its roles is fulfilled one of its roles is reunification. And I will be very frank in saying that I don't always believe that's the best option. I think it's very trendy in foster care to say like reunification is always the best option. We always need to put like foster children back with like biological family. And that's not always the best case. And that proved itself true because I went to go live back with my biological mom and we were stable for a little bit. But as time went on, the abuse in my home started to increase. My mom was really struggling with mental illness. I think because she had never healed from the trauma that she endured when she was a teenager and when she was younger. And it was just coming out in her motherhood because motherhood's hard. If we don't take care of our stuff, it's all going to come out in our motherhood and our wifehood because it's just so hard. And so she started to be very abusive and the abuse started to get worse and worse and worse. And so when I was 12 years old, I went into the foster care system again for a second time. And this time I had a sister. She's 10 years younger than me. So she was like about 2 at the time. We went into the system together. I was so relieved. Like it was a complete, like black and white, completely different feeling than how I felt the first time. I was like, okay, like we're going to get stability. Like things are going to be normal. We're going to get to escape the abuse and the chaos. Like I was looking forward to it. I was like, we're going to have a family. And maybe I'm going to have a dad. Like foster care seemed like this really great thing. But abuse had happened in that very first foster home that we were in. Unfortunately, I reported it. They said that I was lying and me and my sister were separated. I went to go live in a residential group home, which I was very upset about. And I was upset because the residential group home, it was for high risk teenagers. It was for high risk kids. And I had never done anything to put me under the umbrella to be considered high risk. Never done drugs, never did alcohol, didn't get into trouble. I was a 4.0 student at this point. And so I was pretty upset. But one of the things that they mandated was they mandated for us to be in therapy. I went to therapy and I was like, I literally was like in therapy. And I was like, I'm just going to go through the motions. Like, I'm just going to do what I have to do and say what I have to say to get out of here. But like, as she was asking me questions and I had to answer them, like, I was like, I'm not going to be, I wanted to like be in there and just not talk, but I knew that that wouldn't get me out. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to talk. And as I was talking, I realized that what had happened when I was living with my mom had actually really hurt me. There were many different behaviors in this home. This home had such an impact on me and not like their programming, but just like in the way that I could see myself for the first time. And it made me realize things about myself really through the therapy. And during this therapy, you know, I realized that growing up with my mom had been really quite hard. And all these girls, we had different behaviors. But one of the ways that my trauma manifested was that, we had point sheets. So if you are not in child welfare, I'm just going to try and like really explain this to you very clearly. So we carried around a clipboard with a piece of paper on it. And every time we did something that was good, quote unquote, good, or that was good behavior, they would have us write down positive 1,000 points. And then we would write down the good behavior. If we did anything bad, bad choice, bad behavior, we would have to write down negative 3,000. Negative 3,000 was the minimum. That was like the starting. And for me, those negative points were just crushing. My mom was someone who really valued achievement. Like I said, when I was like 4, she was like, you got to go to college. My mom was someone who really valued achievement, high accomplishment. She had a really, really high standards for me. And so when I got like negative 3,000 points, it was so crushing. And I would go to my room and I would like rehearse how, like, I'm going to do better. I'm going to do better. And I would like replay in my room how I would react better so that I wouldn't get the negative 3,000 points again. And like the girls, the other girls I was living with, like they got like multiple negatives like in a day. And I would maybe get like one negative a week because I was so like, I have to be perfect. I have to not get it. And like the programming was actually quite, I think it did a bit more damage than it did good. But that is actually one of the things that the therapist pointed out. She was like, this is how your trauma is like crushing you. She's like, you think it's a good thing. And everyone else, it was so wild. She's like, everyone thinks this is a good thing. Everyone praises you for your accomplishments. Everyone praises you because you're the good kid. But the reality is this is how your trauma, perfection is a trauma response. And it helped me see myself in this way that like perfection is the enemy of good. I couldn't have peace. I couldn't just live in the simple goodness because I was always trying to be perfect and I was always trying to wrestle with that. So eventually I left this group home. I moved throughout many different homes. I moved throughout 12 homes throughout my entire time in foster care, which was very hard. You know, you just feel unwanted. You feel disposable. You feel like no one wants you. You feel like no one wants you, loves you, wants you. You just feel like you don't belong. And you're moving from, I mean, people were always like, what was it like moving from home to home to home? Well, it was like, okay, I'm going to go and try to fit in here. I'm going to try to fit into this family and mold in whatever way they need me to belong. But the reality is the opposite of belonging is fitting in. We can't belong and make ourselves fit into something that someone else wants us to be. Belonging is being who God has created us to be. And so I was always trying to be who everyone else wanted me to be. And I couldn't figure out who Tori was. I had track as my escape. I think track, you know, was this one place where I was like, I could be who I felt was most like Tori. And that still was like high achievement, high accomplishment. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I just think when we aim for perfection, it can be destructive. But high achievements and high accomplishments was something that was always part of me. It's something that still is a part of me. And track was kind of like this outlet. That
how old that were you when you started running?
I started running when I was like in the 7th grade, but I wasn't good. Like I was just like, it was just fun.
Just like in gym class or?
Yeah. Well, I started track. So like in Ohio, you can like start track like in the 7th grade, unless you're like on a travel team, but I was poor. And then I went to the foster care system and usually foster parents do not have the bandwidth to have a kid in travel sports right. because they're fostering usually a lot of kids and foster yeah. care is already so hard with caseworker visits and stuff. So I didn't start till the 7th grade. And yeah, it was just this escape. Like I just loved it. And I was okay at it. You know, I was a part of a good relay. And then in between my junior and senior year, I always had a goal. I always wanted to go to state, but I'd never been to state in an individual race. I was going into my senior year and never been to state in an individual race. And my track coach said, I think you can go onto the state track meet and I think you can win it. But he added a caveat and he said, if you do everything I say. So I was like, okay, whatever. I'm going to listen to this old man. I'm going to do everything he says. If it doesn't work out, then it's his old man's fault because it was his idea, everything he said. So if the result isn't exactly what he said it to be, his fault. So I started to do everything he said, started to train. Like he told me how many hours of sleep I need to get a night. He told me like the things I needed to eat and not like super strict diet or anything, but like you need to eat healthy.
Right.
And he would give me like, I was working out of season. So I started training like a year before the state track meet and he would give me a different workout like every day. And through that, we became super, super close. But in between my junior and senior year. So that's when he told me. And then my senior year, I had still, so my birthday's in February. So I still had like a whole semester of high school left. And then I still had my track season left because track season doesn't start till March. Spring, yeah. And my birthday was in February. I chose to emancipate when I turned 18. In Ohio, you have the choice to emancipate or not. You have the choice to leave, at least at this point when I was in care. So it's been 10 years since I've been in care. I feel like we should mention that. So I know that things have changed and things have gotten better. But I wanted to leave the system. I didn't want to be in the system. I felt very burned by caseworkers. I felt like they had labeled me as like this bad kid when I was a 4.0 student. Mm. I had great grades. I was a star athlete. And you're like labeling me as this bad kid, hard to place, like just all these labels on me that I felt like were really similar to the labels that my mom had spoken over me. It was just different. And right. Those labels, those were the things like when people hear about the physical abuse, I think you're like, oh my gosh, you know, that's where your trauma came from. But if I had to name anything that where my trauma came from, it was the labels. It was the things spoken over me, because those are the things still to this very day that like I have to figure out how to wrestle with and how to like when the lies come, I have to literally work to put the truth there. And so I was going into my senior year. Well, I was in my senior year, still had a semester left, and I chose to emancipate. And my track coach, you know, he gave me this goal. We were training together, but then I was instantly homeless, like 20% of foster kids who age out are. And I had no place to go. I did have a foster mom. She's my 12th foster home. And I loved her. So, like, I think it's important. I did not emancipate because of her, because I didn't have a good home. I emancipated because I was like, I don't want anything to do with the system itself, with like the government entity. Mm-hmm. But I love my foster mom. She was really, really good to me. She was taking me to church, and I had seen foster parents who they'd like taken me to church, but it was actually my 11th home where they were taking me to church consistently. But in that they would talk about God, but behind closed doors, they abuse their kids. And so I really didn't understand, like, there's this Jesus who is so loving and so kind and so good, but then his people, like, his people are just putting a mask on. I was like, I don't want a mask. Like, I want to be known. I want to be loved. And I'm already putting a mask on all the time. Like, I don't want a whole extra religion that's making me put on a mask. I was like, I don't want anything to do with it. And then I went to go with my last foster mom, whose name was Gina, and she was taking me to church consistently, very similar to my 11th foster home. But she really was very loving and she was very kind. And in my 11th foster home, I told the foster parents, I was like, my track coach gave me this goal. I would like really love to start going to practice every day and I want new track spikes. And they told me that it was like unrealistic. It was an unrealistic goal. And then when I asked for track spikes, and this story sounds materialistic when I say it, and I know that, but they took me to Goodwill and they got me a pair of track spikes that were two sizes bigger than like my foot. But, and I was like, in the moment, I was really grateful. But then when I went to go live with Gina, she took me to like a sporting store. Yeah. I tried on these brand new spikes and she got me brand new spikes. And it wasn't about the materialistic thing. It was the message she sent that I believe in you.
Yeah.
And I'm going to invest in you. I believe in what God can do through you. And then one of the things that the other foster parents didn't want to do is they didn't want to take me to practice every day because I was practicing out of season. So I couldn't just like get on the bus or like get out of school and go to practice. Like I was practicing with my coach out of season, like not during the practice hours. And so Gina, she started taking me to practice every day, like whenever I needed to be taken, whenever my track coach was available. And what she was saying was like, I believe in your potential. I believe in this dream that you have for yourself, even though I'd never been in the state track meet, an individual race. And like, usually this stuff is very progressive. And she really didn't have like a ton of reason to believe in me, but she was willing to invest in me without knowing what the end result was going to be. And so when I emancipated, I was a part of this church. Because of really Gina taking me, I had come to faith. I had come to believe in Jesus. I had understood, you know, one of my big questions about God was that if he's so good, then why didn't he give me a dad? Mm-hmm. Because I would have had a dad to like maybe protect me from my mom or prevent me from going into the foster care system. And then I realized that like God was my father. God is my father. And he's there protecting me, loving me, always there for me. And so I accepted Jesus into my heart. Still attending this church that my foster mom went to. And I had that community. I really looked to them. A lot of people were involved in foster care. And I looked at them and I thought, maybe if these people care about kids like me, then maybe God cares about me. Mm-hmm. And so I started to ask people, you know, can I live with you? There's this one woman who I tutored her daughter. Her daughter was like a second grader, and I tutored her when I was in high school. And she just said, if there's ever anything you need, you can just call me. And so I called her and I was like, I need a home. And mm-hmm. I came and lived with her, and she had all the best intentions, and her home was like a very safe and normal home. I moved into her basement, and then the first night that I went to go sleep in there, I started to break out in hives, and I didn't know what it was from. So we like went to the hospital, and we found out that I was allergic to black mold. And they had black mold in their basement, and like their home was like very nice. It was just like they had black mold in their basement. So I had to move out of there. And then I went to go live with just like this person from my high school, and I was sleeping on the floor. Their house was like super cold. It didn't have heat. Of course, we're like in February and like late February at this point. So it's cold in Ohio. And I went and I bought a space heater because I had worked here and there throughout my foster care experience. So I had like a little bit of a savings account, went and bought a space heater, and I was like sleeping by the space heater, like stay warm. And I woke up and had like burns on my arm on the side that I slept on. And my track coach was like, what are those? And I was like, they're burns from the space heater, because I'm like trying to, I'm sleeping by the space heater because it's really cold in the house. And he was like, you need a place to sleep that is stable. You need a place where you're going to get good sleep, because you're not going to win this, like, if you aren't getting good sleep. And so there's someone from my church, another person from my church that I asked. She was this woman, her name was Tanya. And every Wednesday she would come pick me up, me and my sister up when we lived with my mom. And she would take us to her house, feed us, and then she'd take us to church every Wednesday. And so I had not really like kept a relationship with her throughout my foster care experience, because my mom had some jealousy of her, and she had told the county, my caseworkers, not to let us be in contact with each other. But once I had emancipated, I was like, can I come live with you? And so she let me live with her. And she was someone that I'm still very close with today. Oh, she's like my mom. She's like my mother figure. And so I lived with her and went to the state track meet that year and became a 4-time state champion in track and field.
Amazing story. Amazing story. But I know that's not the end of the story. I know that's not
There's
the
a
end.
Lot to the story.
There's a lot.
My track coach was driving me to and from track practice. And there was one time he was driving me home, and he said, Tori, when track season is over, because of the legalities of the school, the technicalities of it all, my family, my daughters and I have talked about it, and we want to welcome you into our family, and we want to welcome you into our home. And so that would be like a really cool ending to the story. It really would. But I heard him and I thought, yeah, I've heard that before. And so I kept training with him, and we became super close. He became this father figure in my life. And I had a lot of great mom figures in my life, but I never really had a father figure. And he was this dad that I felt like I always needed. And as we were in between this track season and it being over, he would invite me to his house, and he would cook for me. Him and his daughters would cook for me. They would teach me how to cook. There was this one time, me and his daughter, he had a grill, like, still in the box in the garage. And he left. And we're like, we should put the grill together as a surprise for him. And so we put the grill together, and he came home. And I guess it was backwards. It was completely backwards. But he kept it like that, and he's used it backwards till this very day. Because he says it reminds him of when we were becoming sisters. And so I went to the state track meet, and I was just so grateful to be there. I was like, if I don't win, that's okay. I made it here. I have my family. But that day, God had his hand over my life, and I became a 4-time state champion in track and field. Thank you. Till this day, it is one of the most memorable days of my life. I became the 50th girl ever in history of Ohio to win 4 state titles in one meet, which is as many as you can win in one meet. I became the first individual woman at my high school to be a state champion. All the other state champions still at my high school to this day are men. And I became the first woman of color at my high school to be a state champion. And it was, to this day, one of the greatest honors, and it is what allowed me to go on to college and get a full ride scholarship. I graduated from Hillsdale College in 2018, and only 3% of foster youth go on to get a bachelor's degree or higher.
these things that I was able to do were because of all of the people. I know that I told you a story about me, but really my intent was to tell you a story about a foster mom who was faithful in taking me to church and showed me community. A Tanya who came and picked me up and established a relationship with me from a very young age so that I could eventually live with her and she could show me what it was like to be a wife and a mom. It took Scott, who didn't know what the end results were going to be, but placed this lofty dream in front of us that we could chase together. It's all these people who didn't know what the end results were going to be, but they invested anyway. And it didn't just take one person. You know, there's this idea. If you're in the foster care space, you've heard it a lot. It takes one adult to change the trajectory of a child's life. And I like that sentiment. But what we lose is that it really takes the community. It takes all of us. And if we say it only takes one, then only one of us has to give today. Only one of us has to walk out of here and do something to really make an impact. But really, it takes all of us to change a child's life. It takes an entire community. What I love about Tanya and Scott is that they were models for me. And they're a huge reason I am who I am today. Now I get to do this. I get to advocate for kids who are in the position that I was in.
I know we were talking about it in the car. I would lay there and just listen to your voice talking. The book is called Fostered. You can download it, I think, on Audible.
Any
you can get
place,
it on Amazon. It's a great read. It really is a great read. It's a great story. And of course, it's interesting to me too, just because of the line of work that I'm in and, and what we get to do here at Place of Hope. So
we want to give a special thanks and shout out to our presenting sponsor, Crypto Capital Venture. Crypto Capital Venture acts as both a startup recruiting firm as well as one of the largest crypto communities in the cryptocurrency space, offering trailblazing content for over 5 years. If you're interested in crypto, you can join over 300,000 subscribers on their YouTube channel for the latest on crypto. Just go to YouTube and search Crypto Capital Venture and make sure to subscribe. Thanks so much, Dan, and our friends at Crypto Capital Venture.
Hello, I'm your producer, Maya Elias. Did you know that April is when we recognize National Child Abuse Prevention Month and the importance of communities working together to support and strengthen families and prevent child maltreatment? I would like to share with you all some stories in regards to Child Abuse Awareness Month. In the year 2020, Florida's Child Protective Services faced an alarming reality. They received approximately 185,000 reports of child abuse and neglect. Can you imagine the weight of those numbers? The weight of those young lives? Approximately 36% of all children in Florida's foster care system are under the age of 5. These are tender years where a child should be wrapped in love, not tangled in a system they can barely comprehend. And what's even more heartbreaking? Almost one out of every 5 kids in this situation are dealing with serious mental health problems. These statistics reveal a story that's hard to hear, but one that must be told. They illuminate the tough emotional and psychological struggles that these children face every single day. It shows us just how hard it is for them and for the foster care system to cope with these challenges. But amidst these stark realities, there is hope. There are beacons of light in the darkness like Place of Hope. We are the guardians, the protectors, the ones who refuse to let the numbers define our children's futures. Together, we can be part of that hope. Together, we can combat those staggering numbers, and it is crucial now more than ever to continue advocating for these children. I invite you to be a part of this challenge. I invite you to make a difference today by donating to organizations like Place of Hope. You're ensuring that all children have access to safe, supportive, and stable family environments. Let's rewrite the story for these children. Let's give them the childhood they deserve. Donate today at placeofhope.com/donate.
Now, what, because I don't remember what happened to your dad.
So my biological father passed away a month before I was born.
Oh my gosh.
I didn't know that until I was, so my mom had always told me that. My mom had always told me your dad passed away before you were born. But I think I didn't know if I could believe her. And I always wondered if he was still out there somewhere. And the things that I did know about him weren't necessarily good things, but I still had a desire to meet him if I could, like just to be, there's this little part of me, and this is going to sound really bad, but there's this little part of me that I just wanted to like go to him and be like, I don't want anything from you, but I do want you to see what you missed out on. So I took an ancestry DNA test, and I actually took my ancestry DNA test because everyone always asks me what my ethnicity is. And I always said, I don't know. And then people look at you funny. And then they're like, what do you mean you don't know? And then you got to tell them your whole story about how you grew up in foster care and you don't know your dad and all this stuff. So I was like, okay, I need this answer so I can just like tell people so I can stop telling them my whole life story the second that I meet them. Like these strangers on the street, like not strangers on the street don't always want to hear your whole life story, but they ask. And so you're like, okay, here's the story.
That's funny.
So I took an ancestry DNA test to find out my ethnicity. And I ended up, of course, finding a relative from my dad's family side. And I messaged them and I was just like, hey, if you do not want to open this book, that's totally okay. Like, if you don't want to talk about this, it's okay. But I'm pretty sure I am your brother's daughter. My mom had told me his name. And when I looked at the family tree, there was his name. It had said that he passed in January of 1996. And I was born in February of 1996. And so I was like, I think that's him. So like, it's matching up. For a while, no one messaged me back. And then, so the way that ancestry DNA works is the people do not pop up unless they also take the test. You can have a family member out there, but they're not going to pop up unless they've also spit in the little thing, sent it out, you know, someone else, like the person that I initially found never messaged me back. And I was like, that's fine. You know, it's like someone's messaging you saying that they're possibly your niece. Like that's weird. Like, I don't know if I'd respond. I don't know. I probably would, but I get that some people wouldn't. So I didn't take offense to it, just kind of like let it rest. There was another lady that popped up and she actually messaged me. And it also said that she was my dad's sister. Cool thing is that my dad had like 11 siblings. So I was like, I wasn't worried about it because I was like, eventually one of them has to find me. There's so many of them. And she messaged me and she just like asked who I was. And I was like, well, I think I'm your brother's daughter. And this is like the story that my mom told me. And we had kind of talked, we probably talked for about a year and just over text message and just would be like, hey, hope you're doing well, kind of give each other updates. And then after about a year, she said, I want to fly you here and I want to throw a family reunion for you.
Oh,
yeah. So she threw a party for me. And this is, you know, the African-American side of my family. I grew up with a white mom and I don't know much about the African-American side culture side of who I am. And so it was really cool because she made us all comfort food, like all Southern comfort food. And it was just such a sweet family reunion. And I think that God's hand was, I just see how God's hand was over that time as well, because I had a friend who I was friends with. We became friends in college and there wasn't a lot of people. I graduated from Hillsdale College in 2018. And there wasn't a lot of people who went there that were adopted. There weren't a lot of people who went there who were African-American. So, but she was both adopted and African-American. So we just like became friends, you know, it's like, oh, you know, you just like, it's like you see each other in the cafeteria and you're like, oh, like, there you are, like the one person and like who had a similar life as me. And you just feel like a little less alone. And so we became friends and she actually met her biological family, probably about just a few, like 3 months before I met mine. And I remember asking her, I said, what can you tell me? Like, she went into it so stable and then her biological mom didn't show. So she met her biological grandparents, but her biological mom didn't show and she was supposed to. But she came out so stable and okay. And I said, how'd you come out like that? Like, why are you not like more emotional or more worked up? And she said, you know, I just went in with no expectations and I was just grateful for whatever came of it. And so for me, that's how I went in when I met my biological dad's family. I was like, I'm going to go in here with no expectations and just be grateful for whatever comes of it. And I think it helps too, because I had a family. My track coach ended up bringing me into his family. His family ended up becoming mine. That's who my kids call grandpa. That's who walked me down the aisle at my wedding.
That's amazing.
So at this point, you know, I'm not feeling like I need something from them.
Right.
And I'm just grateful. I just see that God's hand was over the situation. And it was such a healthy reunion. It was such a healthy meeting. And it was just exactly what it needed to be.
That's a great story. Not all kids are as, I mean, I want to lightly use the word fortunate, but you were fortunate because there's a lot of blessings that came out
absolutely.
Of some of the things that you've been through, but not every young adult who ages out or emancipates at 18 has the same story.
Yeah.
You know,
people ask me all the time, what can I do? Like, once kids age out of care, like, how can I support them? And I think what people don't realize, and like, I'm for any, you know, obviously you guys are an organization that helps kids who emancipate out of care, but you're also an organization that helps kids before they emancipate. And I think that that's really important, the before, because like when we only help kids after they emancipate, what that is, that's a reactive. That's us being reactive. But when we put all these parameters and boundaries and help kids before they emancipate, what that is that's proactive. It's proactive help. Mm-hmm. We're building a support system for them before they emancipate. So when they emancipate, they have a support system. We're giving them the tools that they need before they emancipate so that when they emancipate, they have the tools they need. That was why I was so fortunate. I had a community in my church. I had a vision for my life that was track and college, again, before I emancipated. I had a plan. I remember my church sponsoring me to take like the Dave Ramsey course mm-hmm. when I was in high school. I don't really remember a lot of it. And I remember thinking like, I don't know what a lot of this stuff means. But then when it's coming at you as an adult, you're like, oh, I remember that. And so if we can give kids the resources before they emancipate, even if they aren't getting it in the moment, when they become an adult, they're gonna be like, oh, I remember this, I learned this, and they're going to be able to use the tools and the skills that they learned. I was so fortunate because I had these people invest in me before kind of the rug was pulled out from underneath me, in a sense.
Yeah.
Today, we're diving into a critical issue that affects us all, child abuse. Did you know that preventing child abuse isn't just about doing the right thing morally? It's also a strategic move in breaking the cycles of poverty and homelessness. Studies have shown time and time again that children who experience abuse are at a significantly higher risk of facing economic hardship and even homelessness later in life. But here's the good news. By investing in their safety and well-being today, we're not just changing lives. We're investing in a brighter tomorrow for everyone. Imagine a future where every child has the opportunity to thrive, where the cycles of poverty and homelessness are broken, and where our communities are stronger because of it. Join us in this mission. Come together with Place of Hope as we work tirelessly to break these cycles, one child at a time. Together, we can build a future where every child has the chance to reach their full potential. Visit our website at placeofhope.com to learn more and find out how you can make a difference today.
We were talking about like what Place of Hope does, and you were asking me about the campuses and, you know, who we're serving and where we're serving and what we're doing. The campus, well, we've got a couple of different campuses, but down in Boca specifically, we're serving kids who have, you know, been with Place of Hope maybe, or they've been with another agency. They've turned 18. They've elected to stay and continue in the program. We've had kids that have come to us that, you know, COVID, perfect example. Yeah. Florida Atlantic University is right in our neighborhood, and those dorms shut down. And the kids that ended up homeless or living in their cars were all former foster kids. And I think our first three or four young adults that came to live in a two-story apartment that we opened the week before everything got shut down, all were out of the foster care system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's pretty remarkable when you look at the statistics of what happens to kids or what can happen. Yeah. The homelessness, the pregnancy, the drugging up the human trafficking. And that's something I kind of want to go in that direction with you, because I know that one of the things that I remember, I hear you saying the words at the end of a chapter, I believe, and you said, I was being groomed. And that was like shocking. I wasn't expecting to hear that in your story, but these kids are so vulnerable to that.
Yeah.
You know, and there's so many ways now that these predators can get to our kids.
Yeah.
I mean, social media and technology is just unbelievable. Tell us a little bit about kind of that experience and kind of, you know, if you feel like you want to share that.
I feel like one of the tricky parts about that experience and this is just true for a lot of human trafficking survivors. And I think it's why I'm hesitant to share it, is that like I was saying yes, you know, I was willingly going about and doing it, but I didn't realize what was being done. Mm-hmm. Vulnerable youth who do not have stable homes, who do not have a consistent, loving family, become so vulnerable to trafficking because that's what we're looking for. We're looking, you know, men, these people who prey on children in the situation I was in, they come and they promise. They promise home. They promise stability. They promise love. They promise marriage. They promise all these things that, you know, it would be a dream to have. And I think that that's what I wanted. I think that's why it's so easy to just fall into it and not realize what is being done. And that's really what it was. I was promised marriage. I was promised to be with a person together forever. And that was all like, wow, that would be a dream to not have to keep fighting for love, to not keep fighting for someone to take care of me, for me to stop fighting, you know, being in the same place. And so I did these things, and then I didn't realize what was being done until it was on a college campus, actually. And one of the roommates, you know, told me what was being done. And so it's just such a hard situation, I think, for people who are already have so much trauma that they haven't healed from, to recognize what trauma they're experiencing in the moment.
Another thing we were talking about is just your willingness to tell your story and how important that is and how healing that is for you. And, you know, that you were so excited to know that we had some of our young adults in the audience today. Yes. And then you told me about a course that you're teaching to kids who've come out of these situations, kind of how to tell their story. I would love to know, you know, more about that and maybe share like a success story or some that you've worked with.
This is like my greatest passion. This is my whole heart, because there are synapses in our brain. There are literally nerves in our brain that begin to change from shame to pride when we tell our stories to empathetic listeners. Mm-hmm. So when we tell our stories to empathetic listeners, you know, about something that's been done to us that was hurtful, but we share it with someone who responds compassionately, mm-hmm. who responds and says, wow, that helped me. We begin to change the way that we view ourselves and the ways that we view our stories. And what my job has become, right, what my job is telling my story to hundreds of empathetic, compassionate listeners. And so my brain has literally completely changed the way that I view my story. It's changed the way that I view myself. It's been so healing. And I think people always ask, like, how have you healed? And I think, you know, of course, there has been therapy. There have been times where I have taken medication, and there has been my community. There are so many different modalities to therapy, or different modalities to therapy and healing. However, I think one of the most underrated modalities for healing is telling your story. Mm-hmm. And I don't think people think of, we need to give people opportunities to tell their stories to people who have compassion, so that people will respond to them in ways that heals them. You know, it's just not like a typical way that we think about healing. But for me, it has been one of the most healing experiences ever. And so I want to offer that experience to other survivors. And so what I started doing was I started hosting retreats for survivors of abuse, trauma, former foster youth, human trafficking survivors. And we just walk them through, how do we tell our stories? How do we even unpack our stories? How do we know our stories? And how do we communicate them? Because we've all been at that fundraiser where a child or a young adult has been put on a stage before they are ready to, and they are uncomfortable and they are crying, it doesn't make the audience cry. It doesn't make the audience like want to give. It makes the audience uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It makes the audience pity someone that we should be dignifying, right? And so, which I'm so grateful. Of course, y'all did not do that at all. And I was so thankful because I see it at fundraisers all the time. And I'm just like, oh, we can't keep doing this to survivors. It doesn't help them. It hurts them. We need to prepare them before we do this. Mm-hmm. And if we prepare them, then it's healing. Then it's powerful. And for them and for the audience, and then for kids who are coming after them. And then it's just this cycle, because what's happened is I've gotten to share my story when I'm ready to share it. And then I get to hear 4 years later, 5 years later, 6 years later, again and again, how my story helped another kid tell their story. And then it becomes a cyclical, right? Like just cyclical way of healing. And it's so beautiful. But then I've done courses. So like just like Zoom coaching, kind of like big groups of survivors who want to tell their stories. Mm. And it's just been so powerful. I think probably the most powerful story was there was one time I was hosting a retreat, and we make these affordable retreats for survivors, because so often if survivors aren't yet ready to tell their stories, they can also be in positions where they can't afford something like to go to a retreat where they're getting this kind of like training. And we bring other speakers and other storytellers who have told their stories professionally for years. And so we bring them in, and the most powerful story was there was this human trafficking survivor who decided to attend one of our retreats, and she had been trafficked by her parents. And her parents had also used the videos to exploit her.
Yeah.
And she was a kid. She was just a kid. And it was cameras, recording, all of that was very traumatic for her. But we did bring like a videographer there to show what we had been doing so that we could continue doing it. So that we could show other girls, you know, other women, other survivors, this is what we're doing. And we want you to be a part of it. And we had like a consent form. She signed the consent form. But then when we got there, she was very triggered. And she was like, I don't think I can do this. Like, I don't think I can do the camera. So we're like, that's fine. We're going to shut off all the cameras. And so the rest of like the thing, we had like very minimal cameras. We were only really doing them when she wasn't like around, if she was like in a different small group or off group. And then we got to like the last day. We were like at the beginning of our last day at the retreat. And she was like, I think we should make a video. And I was like, a video of what? And she said, I think we should all make videos of this experience and what it means to us.
Oh.
And so I was like, okay, let's do it. And so we got the videographer, and they all started kind of talking about their experience and their testimonies of what it meant to them. And she, that specific girl, got in front of the camera, and she shared. And then she pulled away from the camera and she just started weeping. And she said, I did it. Oh, I did something good. Yeah. I did something good in front of a camera.
Yeah.
And that is just something that is how you know, like, God is in something, because we could not have planned that. We could not have manufactured that anyway. It was nothing like I was expecting, but it was so powerful. It was so amazing. And yeah, I think it was the power of her. The wild thing is we literally gave her the training to share her story. And then she said, I'm going to share a story on camera. And that was a part of her healing experience.
That's tremendous.
So
it's great to see how God has taken your story and you're now using it to help other kids. You are definitely a voice for the voiceless and countless generations. Your light is so bright. You know, so bright. I've listened to so many. I think I've watched a lot of videos. I've listened to you on at least 4 or 5 podcasts.
Oh my gosh, thank
Kurt
you.
Cameron.
Oh, thank you.
I've listened a lot. So I just think it's great that you're using that. But that's biblical. That's what God wants us to do with our pain. I remember speaking to one of our kids who told me his grandma said, don't waste your pain. Don't waste your pain.
Yeah.
Use it. But I think that little workshop or retreat or class or whatever you call it would be really something neat for some of our kids to maybe experience. Yeah. Because if you have the opportunity to put them in front of a group of people to speak, they're the greatest storytellers. Yes, but, absolutely. You know, I don't ever want to do anything that's going to make them upset. Or trigger them or cause any kind of issue because, you know, we don't want that. We don't want them to feel that way.
But it is such a good opportunity. You know, it was my church when I was 17. Yeah. They gave me my first ever speaking engagement. And I think that we should give those kids opportunities. Mm-hmm. We should give them speaking engagements. Obviously I was one of them. And what it did for that very first time was that it showed me that I had a story to tell. It showed me that I had a testimony. It showed me that God had done something in my life mm-hmm. that could influence and impact other people. And that what I had been through, you know, it wasn't going to be wasted if mm-hmm. I shared it.
That's amazing. I might have to get you to do that with some, we just formed actually a youth advisory council for Place of Hope.
Oh, awesome. Those are so important.
Yes.
Yes. You should explain, like, because I'm sure you have other nonprofits who listen to you and who want to learn from you. A lot of nonprofits don't even know what that is and why it's beneficial. So you should explain that.
Yeah. So this was our CEO's idea. I think he's been wanting to do this for a long time, but it's finally come to fruition and we've met twice now. We just actually had a breakfast meeting this past week. And not all of the kids were there because they have jobs and they're busy. I want to say there was probably 9 or 10 of them were there. And the first hour was like all business. We were just kind of giving them updates about our campaign and this and that. And this is what's going on at Place of Hope. And then then we turned the tables and I'm thinking, I'm going to get out of here fast. We're almost done. Well, then Charles asked them a question. And you said, you know, here's one of the things that we're facing as an organization. Here's a challenge that we're having with, you know, this or that.
Yeah.
And, you know, what would you suggest? Like, we put it back on them. And these are all kids who have grown up here, mm-hmm. who've all experienced unimaginable trauma, right.
Yeah.
All different stories. And a couple of them are still with us. They still live with us. And yet they're serving in this capacity. And wow, the ideas that were just rolling off their tongue. Yes. I mean, they had so many great ideas and just
I just love it.
It was unbelievable. It was so encouraging. We were all so excited. I was like, this is awesome.
Because you're teaching them? You're showing them that it's not just us serving you. You're serving us. You're not a charity case. You are an investment. And I think that is just like, that is one of the most powerful things that a nonprofit can do is saying, you're not a charity case.
Oh my gosh.
To us. You are an investment. And we believe in your voice as much as we believe in our work. We know that you have value to it. I just love youth advisory boards. What it communicates to youth is just, it's just irreplaceable. You know, that message that you're sending them is so good.
Well, I'm excited to see where these kids take us because, I mean, this the ideas that they had, you know, and in our program, at least for the over 18, there are expectations. There are is accountability tied to, it's not just move in and play video games all day long. There are expectations clear. And the kids are given, you know, agreements to sign and they know these are the expectations. You have to apply. You have to be accepted. It's great to get their feedback once they've gone and moved on suggestions and things that we could do in our program now, because it's a different world we live in right now. I mean, things have changed so much in the last even 5 years. I mean, so what are you doing now? I know those days are behind you, but you're taking your story on the road. You've written a best-selling book and you told me in the car you were writing another book.
You know, thank you so much for asking me that. I'm on podcasts a lot and a lot of people don't ask me, what are you doing now? And that has been something in my adulthood that has irked me a little bit because I'm more than my story. I'm more than a former foster youth. And being a former foster youth will always absolutely be a huge part of who I am today. I am who I am today because I am a former foster youth and because I am my mother's daughter and because I have had the experiences that I did as a kid. But at the same time, I am other things too. And I appreciate that you see that and that you ask that. I am a mom to two biological children. an adopted son who is a young adult. We said that we're Gen Zs, who are parents of Gen Zs. And then I have a 16-year-old foster daughter. Me and my husband really value hospitality, just welcoming people in and from our community. Whether that's, you know, to eat, I love cooking a lot. My mom was, I love my mom so much, but that was one thing she was not blessed with, was making good food. And so when I got older, I was like, how do I make good food? Yes. And I just really value making good food. And I think one of the things that this job has allowed me to do my work, I get to advocate for kids. I've helped change policy on Capitol Hill, and I have been a part of policy change for youth in foster care and at-risk youth. And then I get to advocate for kids from fundraisers. I get to help organizations who are doing meaningful, impactful work for vulnerable children to raise funds so that they can continue to expand and continue to help kids. And then I help communities get their communities involved in foster care and adoption, whether that's helping their communities become foster parents, do respite, become CASAs, safe families.
You are a busy girl.
I'm a busy girl, but I love it. You know,
you've done a lot in your short life.
Any other way. I think that I'm so grateful for the mission that God has given me. But also, I had a friend that recently told me this, and I'm so grateful for the mission that God has given me, but I'm also trying to remember this truth that my friend spoke over me recently. She said, Tori, if you wouldn't have ever helped anyone, God still would have redeemed your story. Mm-hmm. God still would have died on the cross for you. And so trying to live in this full, abundant life, I don't know if we can waste what God has done for us or not, but I don't want to waste it. I don't want to waste the suffering. So trying not to just throw away his goodness and walk away from it, but also resting in the idea that his love for me is enough and I don't have to work for it. But I think the thing is, when you have experienced God's love, you know, when you understand that you truly are loved after going through so much brokenness, after, you know, I know what it's like to not feel loved. I know what it's like to not feel safe. And then when you experience love and safety, your compulsion is to give that, mm-hmm. you know? And so that's what we try to do now in whatever way that we can.
Well, I love following you on your social media, and you do share your kids and all the things that you do with them at home and your activities and the hospitality. And there was a post about a chicken in a pot or something I saw. I remember seeing something with a chicken.
Yes.
And you had invited people over to your house. Aww. That's so amazing. What's your book that you're writing now before we finish up so people can look for that?
So when you write a book, like, you don't actually know the title of it till the end. So I'm kind of sad because I wish I could tell you the title of this, but I actually don't even know the title. And that's really sad. But the book is going to be about breaking patterns in our lives that are destructive so that we can break generational cycles and live healthy, whole lives where we are able to create a safe place for others and where we're able to healthily love others.
That sounds great. I can't wait to read it. Will that be out?
It'll be out February of 2025. So people, if people follow me on social media, then you'll find out what the book title is. Probably when I find out what the book title is.
You'll figure it out. It's going to come to you.
Well, I have so when you are an author, you I have titles. They just haven't approved them yet. So we'll see.
There you go. Well, thank you so much. We appreciate you. And it's just such a joy to meet you, and just keep doing what you're doing. And just an honor to be able to meet you here. And thank you, Amy Kasma, for making it possible. Yes.
Thank you, Amy. Someone needs to tell Amy that I did not leave her. Someone needs to tell Amy that all these people came and sucked me in, and then I was gone. And I'm sorry, Amy, but thank you, Amy. And thank you, Place of Hope, for
having me. Absolutely.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to subscribe and share with your friends so you don't even miss a thing. And if you really gained value today, please be sure to give us a 5-star review so, of course, we can be put in front of more listeners. For details and show notes about today's podcast and how you can connect with and support our guests, please go to placeofhope.com/podcast. And please don't forget to email us at pohpodcast@placeofhope.com. And for sure, follow us on social media, Ambassadors of Hope, placing hope in a child's future.